as a child, Mary Poplin was dean, she eventually became dean of the School of Educational Studies at Claremont Graduate University in Southern California. But as a child, she attended a Methodist church. Yet at the beginning of her adult years, Mary began searching other spiritual traditions, including Buddhism and transcendental meditation, and even for a while, telepathic attempts to bend spoons. But after she began teaching at Claremont, a Christian friend encouraged her spiritual journey. And eventually, in 1993, Mary gave her life to Jesus Christ. And in her own words, I want to read to you her last steps. In January, my mother wanted to go to North Carolina to where she had grown up. We went to see to this little Methodist church, not because my mom was religious. She just wanted to see her friends. When we got there, I was really moved to just go up to the altar and give my life to the Lord. It wasn't even an altar call. It was a communion call. The guy said, you don't have to be a member of any church to take communion. You just have to believe that Jesus Christ lived, that he died for your sins, and you have to want him in your life. And when he said that, I was so powerfully moved that I actually thought, even if a tornado rips through this building, I'm going to get that communion. I took the communion, and I didn't even listen to the guy. I knelt down and said, please come and get me. Please come and get me. Please come and get me. And when I took the communion and I said that, I felt free. I felt like tons of things had been lifted off of me. It's called communion. The Lord's Supper, the Eucharist, the Lord's table. No matter what we call it, it's an invitation to a meal that touches our very soul. I'd like you to turn back to that passage that Trevor read for us in Matthew chapter 26 about the first Lord's Supper. And as we prepare ourselves this morning to participate in communion, I want to bring to your attention three implications about this unique dinner invitation that Jesus gives. And the first one begins there in verse 17, Matthew 26, 17. Matthew records it this way. Now on the first day of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, where do you want us to prepare for you to eat the Passover? And Jesus said, go into the city to a certain man and say to him, the teacher says, my time is near. I am to keep the Passover at your house with my disciples. The disciples did as Jesus had directed them, and they prepared the Passover. Here's our first implication. It's this, is that we're invited to a meal that's made from God's ancient recipes of redemption and release. Why do I say that? Because Jesus built communion on the Passover. For 1,500 years since the beginning of the Exodus, the Passover had been teaching God's people of man's great need, of a man's need for salvation. This sacred observance looks back to God's deliverance of the Israelites from the slavery of Egypt, the plague of death on the firstborn of all in that land. And for the Jews, well, this Passover meal was always a meal with strange flavors and strange recipes. For example, during the meal, there was salt water to remind people of the tears of slavery. There were bitter herbs like horseradish, so people would remember the harsh bondage. And then there was a paste, a fruit paste that was made with cinnamon sticks to remind people of making bricks with clay and straw. And in that meal, the meat was lamb. Remembering how a lamb was killed for every household, its blood sprinkled on the doorposts, signaling the angel of death to pass over. And then there was the flatbread made without yeast to remind God's people both that they were to be holy and ready to travel. Such bread would travel well. It wouldn't spoil. And then there were these Further on in the meal, there were these four cups of wine taken at different parts in the Passover meal. And they're all connected. These four cups of wine were drawn from four promises made by God to Israel. Look in your outline at Exodus 6:6 and mark down these promises, okay? God, speaking through Moses, said, "Say therefore to the people of Israel, I am the Lord, and I will," here's number one, "bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And I will," here's number two, "deliver you from slavery to them. Number three, I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great acts of judgment. And number four, I will take you to be my people, and I will be your God, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God who has brought you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians." Now, why was that so important? Because remember, in that time, most of the cultures, in fact, almost all the cultures, were polytheistic. And you know what the problem with a polytheistic culture is? You don't know who to worship. You're not sure which god. If the sky goes dark, well, maybe it's the sun god. Well, maybe it's the cloud god. We're not sure. And so here comes Yahweh along saying, no, no, let's put all that aside. You have one God, and I'm going to tell you who I am. And I'm going to be your God, and you will get to be my people. This Passover was so precious to Jews because it gave Jesus and his disciples a taste for the ways of God. As they're going through the Passover, what did it do? It reminded them that sin is a life of bondage, like Egypt had been. Sin is slavery, like making endless bricks over and over again, always having to get your own clay and your own straw. This meal would remind them that death would pass over every house, and our only protection doesn't lie in the fact that, oh, I go to Clovis Evangelical Free Church, or I have this strength, or I have this heritage. Instead, it's in the blood of a sacrificed lamb. It reminded them that God is a redeeming God, buying people out of slavery, that slavery of sin. He's a liberating God, sending them out victoriously, safe toward a land flowing with the promise of milk and honey. And these truths about life and God were actually tastes that were acquired in Egypt. I love how one theologian wrote, listen to this, it's just a sentence. The Jews learned their theology at a table. They learned it at a table. And Jesus, in this passage, now wanted to teach his disciples that Passover was just a mere appetizer. How many of you fill up on... No, turn to the person near you. See if they fill up on appetizers. Go ahead. Like at a Mexican restaurant? How many of you eat chips first and then never eat another thing? Okay, good. Confession is good for the soul, bad for the reputation. But he was going to show that Passover was the appetizer and the feast of salvation he would bring. And to this day, communion is ever so much more precious to us when we realize that we taste these ancient recipes of redemption and freedom down through the centuries. Mary Schmick wrote a column for the Chicago Tribune back in the spring of 2000. I loved what she wrote. She wrote, quote, "I have Seder envy." The Seder is their name for Passover, the Jewish name for Passover. "I have Seder envy. I'm stricken by this curious condition every year as my Jewish friends gather to eat and drink and tell the tale of the Jews' liberation from slavery in Egypt. There's something about Passover that makes me want to feel included." And that's the idea, of course, on a much more profound scale than Mary Schmick even realizes, that we're invited to a meal that has eternal implications. Jesus brings his disciples to the Passover meal on the eve of his death so that their taste for salvation would be aroused. Remember, these guys are not really sure that Jesus is going to die. They've heard him talk about it. And you remember through our study of the book of Mark, they were never really ready for it. And Jesus is saying, we're going to make a transition here. Here's a second implication. A second implication is this, is we're invited to a meal that exposes our hearts. Matthew continues the story of the Passover in verse 20. Look with me there. Now when evening came, Jesus was reclining at the table with 12 disciples. As they were eating, he said, truly I say to you that one of you will betray me. Being deeply grieved, they each one began to say to him, surely not I, Lord. And Jesus responded, he who dipped his hand with me in the bowl is the one who will betray me. The Son of Man is to go just as it is written of him. But woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been good for that man if he had not been born. Notice the next verse. And Judas, who was betraying him, said, surely it is not I, Rabbi. And Jesus said to him, you have said it yourself. Look down at verse 31, because Matthew continues the account. Jesus said to his disciples, you will all fall away because of me this very night, for it is written, I will strike down the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock shall be scattered. What a strange meal. What a strange feast that drives one guest away. It leaves all the others unsettled, and it leaves the host of the meal with a broken heart. See, communion is not a safe meal. What happened on that night usually happens when this meal is eaten and accurately understood by God's people. Because see, at this meal, at communion, a pretender can't hide from God's judgment. Jesus saw into Judas's heart where no one else could see. What did he see? The heart of a betrayer, the heart of a liar. Remember in 1 Corinthians 11, starting with verse 27, Paul makes this solemn warning that this is not a meal to be trifled with. It's not a meal to be taken in an unworthy manner because it can literally kill you. Now, that doesn't mean that sinners can't take it, because if sinners couldn't take this meal, then yeah, you got it. None of us could take it, right? So what does it mean? It means that betrayers dare not dine here. Fakes and frauds eating this food literally poison to themselves. Why? Because they're saying something that they don't really mean. They're faking it. Now, for many years, communion posed a problem for me when I heard these solemn warnings out of the Bible about participating in an unworthy manner, because I went to a very small Baptist church, and it was hard to avoid communion. I mean, when you only have like 35 people there and you get up and leave just before communion, everybody notices. Now, my trick was that I pretended that I was going to the restroom, and it was much more not the call of nature but God's call that bothered me the most. At this meal, every disciple, everyone who claims to be a Christian, who claims to be a follower of Jesus, we invite the Lord's examination. We literally say, Lord, examine me. Examine me. I had a professor in seminary. He was so funny. You guys remember the Muppets? Okay? Dr. Bunsen Honeydew? The little round guy, that's exactly what Dr. Roskup looked like. And we came to the first exam, we took the first exam, and we were lost. We were first year students, we were just lost. We wrote down answers, and oh my goodness, and we trembled at having to get these exams back. And he handed them back, and there was this collective, oh great. And he stood and he said, ladies and gentlemen, I am so sorry. This examination shows something. It shows that I haven't prepared you properly. I will do better next time. Let's collect all the exams and I'll throw them away. Oh, yeah, you can take my exam. Go ahead, prof. Oh, my goodness. But see, we tend to think of an examination as something that somebody's going to come down and beat us with it. And God is saying, no, no, this is a time to examine, to say, am I right? And if I'm not right, I can get right with you. The stunning news that the betrayer was among them grieved all the disciples greatly. But it's always been interesting to me that as you read through here, it prompted them to ask what? All the disciples asked, is it I? I love how the New Living Translation puts it. I'm not the one, am I, Lord? It was a question which every one of them expected Jesus to say, no, no, it's not you, don't worry about it. Did Jesus respond? He didn't. He never replied. The fact that while only one would betray Jesus, they would all forsake him. He told them so much in verse 31. Look down there. This very night you will fall away on account of me. John, in his gospel, tells us that these disciples moved very quickly from the shocked question, you know, was it I, Lord? A few verses later, when you read in the gospel of John, what are they doing? They're arguing about who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom. See, there's a sense in which this meal is intended to bring out the worst in us. Not to provoke bad behavior, but to reveal the worst about our very, very fickle and changeable hearts. Nancy Mayers wrote this. I love what she wrote here. I don't partake in communion because I'm a good Christian, holy and pious and sleek. I partake because I'm a bad Christian. I'm riddled by doubt and anxiety and anger, fainting from severe hypoglycemia of the soul. And Jesus' own profound suffering began at this table among his friends. This meal was terribly hard on Jesus. And without a careful look, we miss a couple of the important ideas in this verse. First of all, look in verse 23. Jesus said, the one who has dipped his hand into the bowl with me will betray me. Well, the point is that during this ceremony, everybody had dipped into that same bowl. That same bowl of fruit paste that was part of the meal. That's what friends did. And Jesus was saying, my betrayer is one of my closest, most intimate friends. And the other thing lost on us in this culture is that Jesus was the host of the meal. And in that culture, the absolutely essential is that no one would ever speak ill against the host, let alone betray him. I was puzzled for a long time on why the betrayal by Judas was necessary. In God's plan, why did Judas have to betray him? Jesus could have been arrested. He could have been crucified without a turncoat if God had planned it so. And the conclusion I came to was simply this, is that for Jesus to drink the full cup of human experience and suffering, the betrayal by a dear and trusted friend was part of the deal. It was the heartache that was foretold, foreshadowed by David. I believe I wrote it there in your outline. And if I didn't, it's Psalm 41:9, where David says, even my close friend whom I trusted, he who shared my bread has lifted up his heel against me. Please don't forget, Jesus loved Judas. It was grief enough to be forsaken by all those he loved most, but to be betrayed by a dear friend and to know that such a betrayal condemned that friend to a fierce and eternal judgment surely hurt Jesus beyond description. Think about the kind of people that he brought to a meal. I usually don't bring people to a meal that I know are going to hurt me, that are going to betray me. These dinner guests of God, one would betray, the others would just leave and forsake him. Back in the middle 90s, there was an interview with Sister Helen Prejean. She was made famous in that 1995 movie, Dead Man Walking. It was about her work with condemned prisoners, condemned murderers. She had a new book at the time that dealt with the execution of people she believed were innocent. And one such man was a man named Dobie Williams. you know, kind of on the scale, mildly mentally disabled. But he was convicted of murder and condemned to death. But in prison, Dobie had become a Christian. And she explained an unusual custom in that Louisiana penitentiary where Dobie was incarcerated. Here's what she writes. Warden Burl Kane is a born-again Christian who believes that in capital punishment, he's basically sending people on to God. He makes sure that they have spiritual advisors and really good preachers who come. The warden invites the condemned prisoner to have his last meal with him. You hold hands, you say a prayer, you eat the meal, the warden presides. Seated at the table are the guards of the prisoner's choice, who are later going to strap him down and kill him. Sister Helen writes this. Dobie was wonderful. He looked at me and said, Sister Helen, I don't think I'm going to eat that meal with that warden, because this is not like no real Christian fellowship. Because when we get up afterwards, they're going to get up and kill me. And the sister said, Dobie, you don't have to eat that meal. Doesn't it remind you of that Last Supper? Think for a minute, sitting, reclining in that Last Supper, knowing one person's going to betray me. All the rest, in the time that I really need them, are going to split. It's a meal, to be sure, that exposes each heart. It exposes our heart when we come here. But most precious of all, it's going to expose the heart of Jesus. It's going to show what he feels toward us. And this comes to our third implication, is we're invited to a meal that feeds our deepest needs, our deepest hunger. There's hardly a passage of scripture that we're more familiar with than the next verses, which is just as Jesus wants it. Look at verse 26. While they were eating, Jesus took some bread and he broke it. And after blessing, he broke it and gave it to the disciples and said, take, eat, this is my body. And when he had taken a cup and given thanks, he gave it to them saying, drink from it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for forgiveness of sin. But I say to you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. Why does this meal feed us? Because our deepest hunger is not for physical food. It is for filling the hole that's inside of us. Jesus himself, given for us, is food for our journey. Ever wonder why Jesus didn't make the meat of the lamb as one of the elements of communion? He made bread. Bread made without yeast. It's a biblical symbol of holiness. Yeast was an image of sin, all that puffs up and ultimately spoils. And Jesus for us is like dining on holiness. He's food for our souls that never spoils. He's food for our souls that only strengthen. He's food for our souls that nourishes righteousness and grace deep within us. Remember in the Exodus, God required Israelites to make unleavened bread so that they would have food for their journey out of their bondage to freedom. But here is bread that would last for our journey, that wouldn't spoil. It was bread of pilgrims. It's bread of people who are going through life, who have to pass through that wilderness. And it always struck me that in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, the name for this feast, it's translated the Feast of Unleavened Bread. In Hebrew, it's the Feast of Matzah. Simple crackers. But that's what Jesus is for us. That simple meal that nourishes. Because we hunger for God, Jesus' blood is poured out for forgiveness. It seals our covenant with him. Look again at verse 27, would you? It says that Jesus took that cup, and what happened with that cup? He gave thanks, he offered it to them, he said, drink from it, all of you. This is the blood of my covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. This seals the deal between us. And I imagine what was happening to the disciples is Jesus is taking them back to when Moses secured Israel's commitment to God's old covenant. Look in your outline again, Exodus 24:6. Moses is standing before over a million people. And Moses took half of the blood from the slain lamb. He put it in the basin. Half the blood he threw against the altar. And then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of all the people. And they said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do, and we will be obedient. And then Moses took the blood and threw it on the people and said, behold, the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words. We fast forward to this day in Jesus' time, and once again, blood would be shed for the making of a new covenant established between God and his people. But this time it was going to be a covenant that's written on our hearts. It's going to be purchased with the blood of God's Son, Jesus Christ. And the cup that's talked about here, scholars think was probably the third cup of those four Passover cups, the cup of redemption. They were celebrating the promise, I will redeem you with an outstretched arm with mighty acts of judgment. Who would ever guess that God's mighty act of judgment would fall on his Son and not on us? So that people of God from every language, every nation, every people, every tribe could be united. And because we hunger, we also hunger for hope. This meal carries the promise of eternity. Look down at verse 26. Many people believe that Jesus had this fourth cup in mind when he said, I tell you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until that day when I drink it anew with you in my Father's kingdom. Remember, that fourth cup was God's promise, I will take you as my own people and I will be your God. And down through the centuries, even today, the Passover Haggadah, the Passover liturgy, repeats words like, this year we eat in the land of bondage, next year in the land of promise. So in this communion cup that we take is going to be the promise of redemption and the promise of reunion. It's going to be a reminder that we have something that's going to satisfy us very, very deeply. Pastor Steve Brown once wrote this. He says, the world drinks to forget. The Christian drinks to remember. To remember both our redemption and our promised reunion. In a few moments, we're going to come to this simple meal. It's a reminder of the strength for life's journey, the hope for eternity. In our tradition, we usually regard communion as a memorial in keeping with Jesus' words, do this in remembrance of me. But over the years, I've grown increasingly certain that what happens here at a time like this is a little more than that. It's this reminder that we have this strength for the journey. What do we have today? We have a meal rich with the ancient recipes of God's grace and freedom. It's a meal that lays bare the secrets of our hearts, and it's a meal that brings health to our very souls.